Good morning. You are watching Deep Program with Ted Rall and Jamarl Thomas. It is Monday, May 11th, 2026. Jamarl is wrapping up his own private show over with his guest, Mark Sloboda, who I miss talking to, and we should probably get on at some point. But Mark has a way of, you know, just going and going and going. He's like the Energizer Bunny of post-Soviet political analysis and military analysis. So I can see how that could easily happen. Thanks everyone for joining us. Please like, follow, and share the show. We really appreciate you joining us. And of course, we really appreciate your support. Good morning, Robbie. And thanks for sitting in for the minute or two while JT comes in to join us.
Yeah, hey, no, it's all good. I'm happy to do it. And I'm just over here just watching. And one thing I'll say about Mark, I don't mind that the man likes to talk a lot. And here's why. It's because more often than not, the man gets it right. There's a lot of your talking heads. There's a lot of your analysts who are there online. And they are really good at bloviating and selling you a yarn. But they are consistently wrong. Mark Sloboda is consistently right. And that's one of the things I really love about that guy.
Although my experience has been, Robbie, that the more right you are, the less likely you are to be invited as a guest on mainstream media. It just doesn't happen. There's JT. Let's
What's add happening, him. Guys?
Good morning, JT.
Speaking of Mark Sloboda.
Yeah, we were explaining that situation to anyone who's watching who may not be aware of Mark's proclivity for the gift of gab.
Yes. I hate stepping in being like, hey, wait, I hate doing that. I try to ask the question in a way that gives me enough time to pretty much end it. And sometimes when a person is talking, they end up on another point that is important. Like Mark was talking about the wars and how like people are like agitating for Russia. There are a lot of people who are pushing Russia hard saying, dude, why is this taking so long? Why aren't you finished? And why don't you drop in a regiment going, Kiev and get this over with? And he was pointing out how, you know, war has changed. It's kind of like in the Second World War when French were doing cavalry charges, they would get crushed. They would just get swamped out by machine guns. And it took a while to say, hey, our military doctrine no longer works. And that's the point he's trying to make. Like superpowers, quote unquote, a superpower couldn't take on a regional power like Iran, or the very least couldn't necessarily win that war. And so what's the expectation of Russia going to Ukraine when all of Europe and the U.S. is effectively helping? And that war has changed. You're now in a fishbowl. So it's not like Barbarossa, where a million Germans line up and they could just invade. That million Germans would get crushed because there was 24-hour footage of the line of contact and 24-hour footage of the battlefield with munitions that could pretty much hit at any point, including drones. And his point was they're penny packets in a way that they effectively invade and build up. But the AI has taken a huge role in that, whether in Israel's murder of Gaza, where they were using AI in order to make determinations in regards to targeting to be more efficient at killing, or on the battlefield, we have flying killer robots that are just looking at the battlefield and now can discern that's an airplane of another country. I need to blow that airplane up with a drone. Or these are people who are on the ground and they're correlating or coming together. We need to blow up that particular location. And you can hit it anywhere on the battlefield. Now, he moved into the AI conversation as he was having a conversation about the war. It's just, I'm sorry. I will do better.
I am like, yeah, look, I love Mark and I've been there and I've gone over with him in the past. So I totally get it. If you were on, like, I remember when I was on commercial radio on KFI AM 640 Los Angeles, it was like, doesn't matter. you can't be nice. Like the news is exactly at, 9 o'clock and like, it's coming whether you're done or not. So,
it was like that on a network, radio network, right? Yeah. It's like, we got to stop at the hour.
It stops for no man. Yeah. It's not rude to point out the time. Okay. So, well, maybe it is, but it shouldn't be. Okay. So, basically, there's a lot of stuff about Israel today. Netanyahu gave an interview to 60 Minutes. He said some interesting things there. Human Rights Monitor, Euromed Human Rights Monitor, based in Geneva, issued a report that says Israel employs systemic sexual violence in its jails and prisons that are holding Palestinians. Six people have been found dead, probably migrants, inside a cargo cargo boxcar in Laredo, Texas, right on the border with Mexico. Last but not least, Josh Gottheimer, he's a New Jersey Democrat in the U.S. Congress, is arguing something I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, you and I have heard this, but basically that the left, that Democrats always point out when Republicans or when the right is anti-Semitic, but they give the left a pass, in particularly when it comes to criticism of Israel. And look, I have largely dismissed this critique for a long time. I don't think it's valid. I think I don't want to give it a lot of time. But I think from time to time, it's always good to check in with your adversaries and criticisms like this to see, okay, well, wait a minute. I don't want to have an assumption and just sort of be like, this is the way it is. Israel is genocidal. The end. I'm not, they deserve all criticism they have coming. When someone makes this kind of discussion and they do it in a reasonable tone, like this guy did, I think it's worth checking in with, like, just sort of like, well, wait a minute here. Let's go through his critique. And so I thought that was worth checking into. So anyway, what do you want to talk about?
Let's start there. Okay. Let's start there. You have it. Hello. Look, if obviously the anti-Semitism thing has been used as a way of trying to stem and inhibit critique of a genocidal state, meaning these guys are murdering people en masse, and Netanyahu and many of them will come out and say, we are a Jewish state. We are doing this for the Israelis, but basically we are a Jewish state that is effectively doing this, meaning this genocide is committing in the name of Jews. I didn't say that. He's saying that. Mm. That's not me doing it, right? And so when people criticize Israel and Israel claims they're a Jewish state, obviously, there will be people who would take that to excess. When I talk about it, I talked about it from the context of a state, and I talk about it from the point of view of Israelis, because I'm trying to point out that it is a state that is doing it. It's not about their religion. Yes, religion might be used as a stalking horse in this, but this is about a genocidal state that is carrying out the murders. And I could criticize that state like I criticize any state that is carrying out large-scale murders. If some people take it into excess, I get it. But the reality of it is they are the ones that are conflating Judaism and Zionism in the process of this large-scale execution. So I accept, right, that there may be people who are anti-Semitic on both sides of the fence and just in general. But that can't be used as a scapegoat to stop people from criticizing what is taking place in the context of what they are actually doing. And again, I want to point out that they are conflating Judaism and Zionism, not me. What are your thoughts?
And they've been doing that in order to suppress criticism, right? I mean, most people on the left, the vast majority of us, we all agree that anti-Semitism is horrific and evil and completely to be 100% condemned. And so therefore, if it follows that if you can get us to say that if you can conflate Zionism with, Judaism, then logically, if you criticize Zionism, then you're anti-Semitic. The former head of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith just died yesterday, Abe Foxman. As the New York Times called him, a warrior against anti-Semitism. He's been replaced by a far less intellectually honest man, let's put it that way. One of the things that happened is that after October 7th, 2023, Hamas's raid into Israel proper from Gaza, the ADL changed the way that they calculate anti-Semitic incidents. They now include any incident that is criticism of Israel, an article, a protest, anything. So, of course, after October 7th, according to this metric, which is, apples and oranges, anti-Semitic incidents, spiked radically. If you change the counting methodology, you're going to get different results. And that's what happened here. Now, that said, there probably would have been an increase in anti-Semitic incidents legitimately, like attacks or desecrations of Jewish cemeteries or synagogues and so on. But we don't, unfortunately, because the ADL changed their counting methodology, we don't know what those numbers actually look like, right? But anyway, Josh Gottheimer quotes the ADL, cites the ADL statistics. He says, too many Democrats are noticeably and shamefully silent when anti-Semitism comes from the far left at a moment when the ADL is reporting a surge of anti-Semitic incidents in the past 3 years. So it's like you kind of lose me there. But then he gets into this criticism of Hassan Piker, who, full disclosure, I don't watch. He referred to Orthodox Jews as inbred and said America deserved 9/11. I think those are not like completely impossible statements to defend. He said that Hamas, a designated terrorist organization, is 1,000 times better than Israel, which he called a fascist settler colonial apartheid state.
I think it is.
He goes on and on. He says that. He said that there's is this the new standard for supporting military aid and arms sales? Do Democratic members of Congress also believe we should block weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey, given the history of human rights abuses in those countries? Well, I would have no problem with that. But it says the Democratic, this is the part I really wanted to get to, JT. The Democratic condemnation piled on Israel is overwhelming in comparison to other allies. It's also louder than Democrats' condemnation of Iran's regime for the slaughter of thousands of Iranians in December and January. Israel has been decried by some leading Democrats as an apartheid state, but I haven't heard any of them claim apartheid when it comes to how women and LGBTQ people are treated across the Middle East. There's so much to peel apart in that paragraph. So much, right? So first of all, of course we criticize Israel more than other allies because Israel receives more funding from the United States than any other U.S. ally, right? So whatever they're doing, we are financing, we're backing, we're more complicit than we are with, say, whatever Pakistan is doing wrong or Saudi Arabia is doing wrong. So that's part of it. Then it says, the thousands of Iranians killed in December and January. We have no reliable statistics for the number of Iranians that were killed. And there's been so many lies told about it. We know some died. The Iranian government has acknowledged that. The numbers are, one is too many. One is heinous. But let's just stipulate for the sake of argument. But Iran is not our ally. Okay. So what Iran does is not really our business in the same way that what Israel does. It's also like very different, morally for a regime to gun down protesters. So we're talking about like a Tiananmen Square type situation, or where it's basically where it views itself as defending itself from protesters and internal agitators, then what Israel is doing, which is an attempt to eradicate Palestinians in order to steal their land in Gaza and the West Bank, systemically. The systemic aspect of this is different in the same way that the systemic aspect of slaughtering Jews in World War II with poison gas in industrialized killing facilities is different historically than shooting them in a battlefield. And finally, you haven't claimed apartheid when it comes to how women and LGBTQ people are treated across the Middle East, because that's loathsome, but it's not apartheid. Apartheid has a specific meaning where you have people live depending on their ethnic status or their racial status or their identity or where they live. They receive a different treatment at the hands of the government. For example, in the West Bank, if you are Jewish in Israeli and you commit the same exact murder as a Palestinian commits, you, the Jew, will not be subject to the death penalty. But now under the new law, the Palestinian committing the same exact act will be hung to death. I mean, that's apartheid. Discrimination based on, homophobia, transphobia, and so on are horrible, but it's not apartheid. So I don't know. It's just, it's like, is it me, or do people just think words don't mean anything anymore?
I think they think words don't mean anything anymore. People are bad actors in the arguments they effectively make. This is a horrible argument. I mean, look, it is loathsome to treat somebody differently because of their sexuality or because of, other factors.
Of course.
But that is different than creating, like I say, a regime in South Africa or a regime in Israel where people are materially different and it's second-class citizens. And let's be honest, murdered or beaten because of it. Like, I mean, the reality of it is they raped a man in prison with 60% of the population saying it was okay for them to do so. And for a huge number of people to raid the military base in order to break those people out of jail after doing so on TV. Like, this is outrageous, right? But this is what you get in West Bank, where there's a clear disparity between how Palestinians are treated and how Israelis are treated. And you have mobs and gangs that consistently work with the military to steal land, beat people, and kill people. I've spoken to people in the region who were beaten the day before the interview. Like, meaning this is the conditions to which these guys exist in as a norm, with military force backing pogroms in with the West Bank, or even the Gazification of Lebanon. And let's also be clear, many of the people that were killed in those protests, the Israelis admit to putting those people up to the protests, meaning a long-term operation in order to get people turned out, to give the impression to Donald Trump that, hey, there's huge internal division. You can knock over the government with a military strike. I mean, Trump kept saying, we're going to work with the, we're going to help the Iranians, et cetera. All of this stuff was planned. Trump came out complaining that the Kurds didn't give the weapons that they thought they were going to give for some kind of internal rebellion. So who actually are the people that were being killed in these protests in earnest? I hope you get my point, right? This wasn't, there's just internal dissent. There was this typical government plan of trying to create protests and using those protests as a justification to knock over a particular government claiming that there's some kind of internal support. Same thing with Kiev and Ukraine, with the whole Maidan push. Same thing. Jesus Christ, it's a playbook at this point. They tried to do the same thing in Georgia. They tried to do the same. Like, you can go from country to country where they were using these, this thing of protests and using protests as a way, almost like an Arab Spring type deal. I think this argument is in bad faith. Do you think this argument is in bad faith? Because sometimes I can't tell.
Sometimes I can't tell either, right? I mean, during the pro-Gaza demonstrations at Columbia University, which was the most high-profile encampments during that period, I snuck onto campus because I'm an alumni. So I have an alumni card. And I went in there and looked around, talked to some people, took some video. And in fact, I did a live cast on the old TMI show, were we still on Sputnik? I don't even remember now. Anyway, point is I did that show from there. Anyway, I'm sorry if I've mentioned this before, but I don't think I have. So while I was there, there was this on college walk, you know, so the encampment was boring. Nothing was going on. People were just in their tents. The weather was a little bit overcast, and people were just sort of chilling. There was no chanting, no yelling, no one was carrying any signs. People were literally lying down and just relaxing. And this woman, obviously Jewish, in the arms of a rabbi, was sobbing uncontrollably in front of me. And she was like, how can they think these things? How can they feel this way? I don't understand. It's so horrible. And I was really confused because it was kind of like, I was like, am I watching like Buffet Froid, the French farce from the 80s where everything is opposite world? Because I'm looking around like, what's she responding to? Like literally nothing's going on. There's tents, there's some Palestinian flags. That's it. And even there were, one of the rules that was posted at the entrance to the encampment said, do not engage with Zionists. In other words, they weren't looking for a fight, right? Like if people come in here with an Israeli flag, we're not going to talk to them or yes, because that raises the temperature, right? We don't want that. So there's no temperature being raised, and yet this woman was hysterical. And I had to conclude that it was because she was simply upset at the idea that anyone was criticizing Israel, might be angry at Israel to the point of being willing to sit in a camp for day after day after day in a tent in the middle of a college campus and not rather than go to class. I mean, it was a purely emotional response. I guess my point is, I wonder if someone like Josh Gottheimer has a similarly emotional response to any criticism of Israel, and in his mind, and as it was in her mind, that felt like anti-Semitism to them. And I think it does to some Zionists. I think some of them really genuinely must feel that an attack or any criticism of Israel is an anti-Semitic comment and therefore deeply personally hurtful. I don't think that's true all the time. I don't think it's true about someone like, you know, I mean, not that he's not Jewish anyway, but John Fetterman, I think, is full of shit. I mean, the current head of the ADL is full of shit. He knows better. He's too smart. He's not that emotional. I think, you know what I mean? I think there's a bell curve there. I think it's like, but it's worth checking in because, look, the last thing that anyone wants to do I'm going to read this comment because I think this is good. And F you so, thanks for the dollar. If you're on the side of Israel and imperialism, then you're not left. You're a vapid, worthless, virtue-signaling liberal. And I agree with that. And I also think you can't be on the left and be anti-Semitic. So, and that's why, I mean, anti-Semitism is an ideology of the far right. And, you know, it doesn't go with being a leftist. Being a leftist means that we think everyone is human and must be treated accordingly. And that's just not anti-Semitism, so I'm not part of that. But so that's why up until now, the conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism has been such an effective tool in the Zionist, in the Zionist propaganda wars. And I think it's worth engaging with, right? It's kind of like we can just sort of, I mean, there's a lot of power to being saying, we're tired of your shit, shut the fuck up. Look, I'm down with that. But I also think on occasion, we need to just take a beat and ask this question.
I don't have an issue asking the question. I mean, I'm not into the anti-Semitism thing. I think being racist or on any of this stuff is problematic, to put it mildly. And that's why I try to make a distinction between Jews as a group and Israelis as a group, because I don't think those things are equal to each other.
No.
There are plenty of Jews who were out there protesting. They were getting their ass kicked by the government for protesting what Israel is doing.
Most of the Jewish students and faculty at Columbia, I mean, most of the students and faculty at Columbia who were expelled, suspended, or had their degrees stripped or were fired were Jewish.
Yes. Basically, don't do this in our name. So I don't make this, you know, I don't make this conflation between the two. There are obviously Jews who are out there like, this is outrageous what you guys are doing. We went through a genocide. Why are we doing this to somebody else? And basically having a genocide committee against us.
And that's not a single percent, you know, sort of like, oh, the weird Jews. This is a mainstream view among Jews.
Yes. Yeah. Especially in America, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I get it that you have some who make this conflation and then get out there and weep and everything else. I feel bad that the woman is conflating these two things. I don't have an issue with this woman in general for who she is. I have an issue for what she supports. Those are two very different things, right? And people can make that distinction, even though I would like to point out that the state of Israel does not make that distinction.
No.
Meaning, if people go too far, on some level, the state has to accept blame for that, considering they call themselves a Jewish state that is in the process of committing a genocide, not to mention the rapes and everything else.
And they're expanding the genocide into southern Lebanon now.
Yes. Yeah. At least they're trying to. But they're finding out that, as Mark pointed out, war has changed and that Hezbollah and the drones are effectively taking a plug out of them.
Let's hit some more comments. Manchild, thanks for the donation. Does Gottheimer really expect us to believe his outrage is principled? Or is it just the script that comes with being APAC's $2 million human sock puppet?
It's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit of both. Because the reality of it is, whether he's making this argument in good faith or not, as you point out, there are people who hear this argument. And let's be very clear. I've had guests on my show who are Jewish, who was completely against what Israel was doing.
Oh yeah.
And they explained very clearly. They was like, look, when you are a child, you are inundated with this idea of the Holocaust, of genocide. They give you free trips to the concentration camp so you can see what took place. Meaning they are programmed on some level to be very reactive to this specific argument. And so when they are responding this way, not all of them are acting in bad faith. Some of them have just been programmed in a sense. Mm-hmm. We don't get that as African Americans. Like, we're not taken to slave camps. We're not taken to, you know, we're not inundated with this in a way where we're hyper reactive to the reality of it, where we can make this argument for everything. Well, slavery happened, so we should get a pass. We don't get that. They do.
They don't. Right. I mean, I think, look, fundamentally, the creation of the state of Israel was based on such an illogical and faulty and immoral set of assumptions, you know, like, you know, a land without people for a people without a land, as if nobody lived there before, you know, or that those people didn't deserve any consideration who lived there before. All that stuff is, you know, when you set up a construct like that, you know, it ends up being built on increasingly flimsier scaffolding. And that's all you're seeing here, right? I mean, it's like if you start to, you know, it doesn't make any sense, especially since like Palestinians had nothing to do with, you know, what happened to during the Holocaust. You know, it's like, it's just, I mean, it would have been politically and historically problematic to take away part of Germany in order to provide a homeland for Jews, but at least it would have been logical.
You know,
you can kind of get it. When you learn about the creation of the state of Israel as a kid, you're kind of like, but why do you put it there? It's like, oh, it's the Holy Land. It was promised thousands of years ago by God. Okay, that's not a real argument. I'm sorry. It's just not any argument that says, well, you know, I talk to God. Okay, so the way I look at it is anybody who tells me that they talk to God, I call 911. I'm like, hey, there's a loony here. Come and pick him up, right? So because people, you know, sane people don't claim to talk to God. Right. Even if they do talk to God, they keep it to themselves, right?
They're right.
Not to do that. So, it's always like you ever notice that people who claim to talk to God, it's always self-serving. right? Nobody ever says, oh, I was talking to God, and he's like, you know, Ted, you're such a dick. You know, you need to straighten it up and do this and that. It's like, no, I talked to God. Yeah, oh, JT, so I was talking to God, and he says that, you know, you should come over to my house and cut my lawn.
Right.
It's like, it's never like, oh, God said I should come over and cut your lawn, you know.
Right. Yeah, God told me to do this. Yeah, it's always self-serving. Yeah, and you make a really good point, right? Like, they act as if, because a genocide was committed against them, that they get a pass on committing a genocide against somebody else, or it's okay that they take somebody's land because of genocide. I've even heard them make this argument. It's like, well, look what happened to us. There needed to be some kind of
rough justice.
There needs to be some kind of remuneration, or there needs to be some kind of allowance, some grace given. It's like grace to steal somebody else's land? That's what you believe? I've had the guys come on the show make the argument about this stuff, right? It's outrageous.
Well, dude, by the way, to what happened during the Holocaust, it's not possible for anyone to make up, right? Like Germany can't make it up. Poland can't make it up. I mean, it's just like, aside from the 6.8 million people, right? There's also, you know, the billions, possibly trillions of dollars of bank accounts, insurance policies, real estate, artwork, you know, securities, cash that was stolen. I mean, it was a massive economic enterprise on the part of the Third Reich to steal Jewish wealth. And I think if Germany had to compensate the surviving Jews today, it would go bankrupt. It would be, you know, it's like Germany would have to cease to exist. I don't think they have enough assets that they could do it.
Well, they've been paying billions for years, though.
Yeah, but it's like not enough. I mean, it's not possible.
I mean, look, there's no way to quantify the suffering that was imparted to the Jews, the Poles, the Russians, the Gypsies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can go down the line of the people that they effectively tortured to death. There's no way to find it. There's no way to compensate that. There is no amount of money that could.
It's like slavery. It's impossible.
Yeah, you can't.
That's my problem with reparations. There's just not enough money in the world, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can't compensate for the pain. I don't have to denigrate what those people went through. In contrast of going after the state of Israel, if that makes sense, I can do both. I can say this was absolutely horrendous. By the same token, what you guys are doing, it's horrendous also.
And you should know better, right? You of all people should know better.
What Hitler was doing to the Jews. You're effectively doing that to the Palestinians. I mean, it's astonishing.
Let's see here. I think we have a Robbie question here. I'm going to put Robbie up here. Robbie, this is from Ethan Gaynor. Big fan of the show. Hi, guys. Robbie, after your rant about population on TMI, I was wondering where you stood on homosexuality. Yes, I'm gay. Yes, that's actually my last name. Yes, it's funny. It's like Gloria Gaynor. Okay, anyway.
No,
all right, listen. Robbie, you might be getting hit on here.
Well, it's definitely possible, especially after y'all just mocked every Christian that actually believes what they profess as being mentally insane. So I want to appreciate y'all for doing that. So
and thank you so much. To God directly? Like, I talk to God? And
I talk to him every day. I pray.
I should have, like, you know, fish for dinner tonight?
Well, the question is, does God respond? Issue.
Well, the whole concept of prayer is that you take your petitions before the Lord. So yeah, I talk to him every day. Now, does he talk
about you? Talk to him. Yeah, that's my question. Does he talk to you?
He does through his word. He does through the Bible. He does through inspiration. Right. He does through guidance. But he doesn't audibly speak to you like he did in the Old Testament. But he won't work in signs anymore. It's faith. The faith without works is dead. Meanwhile, it's impossible to please him without faith, and faith is believing in something that you can't see or hear. So now, to answer his question, as a Christian, I'm going to get in trouble for this. Yes, I believe homosexuality is a sin. The Bible condemns it in both Testaments. That being said, what you do in your house, I don't care about. Who you sleep with, though, does not make you a protected class. Like, for example, I sleep with a black woman. That does not make me a protected class, nor does it make her one. What you do in your home, go with God. Don't care, does not impact me at all. No, this is not a Christian country where sodomy was punishable by death like it was 100 years ago. So that's pretty much where I stand with it.
All right, Robbie. Okay, so this one's obviously more for you, FUSO, JT. Will the aliens be MAGA or liberals?
Neither. let me ask both of you a question. Let me ask you this. Because from my point of view, if you had a benevolent civilization that was coming to Earth, could it really make contact in a way that we're not going to consider it hostile? Like, meaning, well, if it was perfectly benevolent.
That's like the day the Earth stood still question, right?
Yeah, there's no way to do it. Like, meaning any interaction, especially from the standpoint of governments or something else, is going to be taken poorly.
Out of an abundance of caution, you have to assume the worst. Yeah, it's not like, hey, maybe they're just here to say hi. Maybe they're just here, they're just curious.
I think it's more extensive, to be honest. Like, for example, when I had Lou Elizondo on the show, Lou Elizondo was the one that ran ATIP. He was talking about, I asked him, I was like, these are small craft that sometimes we're seeing. So how are they getting here? Like, are you telling me this assuming that it's not us, this tiny craft is coming from somewhere else in order to get to here? It sounds like there's infrastructure. It sounds like there are bases. And if you're looking at some of the remote viewing that was taking place by people like Pat Price was effectively murdered at the point where some of the stuff he was coming out with. There are bases here, which means that it's more extensive than that.
Not necessarily, if they're folding space-time.
You mean like portals?
Right. Through like wormholes or just through a fold in space, right? Like, so, because I mean, the big wrinkle is the speed of light. The speed of light is an inherent time limitation. Under normal rules of physics, nothing can go faster than that. So 186 feet per second, sort of.
Gravity can move faster, meaning the folding of space itself could potentially move faster. So the thought is that when, like, let's say for like the Nimitz, for example, or some of the craft that they've been finding, when they had to go fast and the pilots were looking at it, and you heard the pilot talking, and the pilot is like, whoa, look at this thing go. Some of the things that they say is like, they're deflecting our radar. And it's like, well, you don't really know that. Like, you don't know if the deflection of the radar is a principle of the way the ship moves. I mean, the ship may not be moving in a conventional way.
It could be the shape of the ship, just like a stealth bomber deflects radar.
True, kind of. But this deflection seems to be, put it this way, if you were folding gravity, if you were using gravity as a means of propulsion, anything that you fire at it, light moves in a straight line. Mm-hmm. It moves in the direction of space. Gravity curves space.
And so light can curve also in response to gravity, right?
Well, light is just moving in a straight line. Mm-hmm. It's the space that's curved. And so from the perspective of the person who's looking at the light, it comes across as if the light is scattered. It's like if you're looking at a black hole. I don't know if you've seen the images of the black hole that's in the center of the galaxy. Mm-hmm. It looks like light is being coming around it, but what's happening is it's bending space to such a degree that even though light is going in a straight line, from the perspective of the viewer, it looks like light is curving around the object because space is being folded. Mm-hmm. I'm saying a ship that is using gravity as a propulsion mechanism would do the exact same thing to any radar that hits it. Like some of the stuff that they're observing, the speed of the craft and those type of things, can be a manipulation of gravity.
But the problem is that, like, under like Lagrangian theorems and all that, like, is if you go, an object goes with mass goes faster than 186 that, or achieves the speed of light or faster, then it literally fills up the entire universe.
In
the blink of an eye, right?
That's assuming. But if they're using gravity, that's not true.
But I think the universe is such a big place, the galaxy is such a big place that for aliens to be coming from far, far, far away, they need to either live tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, which is possible, or they have to have a workaround, right? They have to.
Yes. Yeah. Hence gravity.
Yeah.
That's why Star Trek uses the warp bubble. I mean, the warp bubble is kind of problematic in general, negative matter and stuff like that. But they use the warp field because of the belief that gravity itself, meaning the folding of space, can go faster than the speed of light. Mm-hmm. There's no limit to it in the context of gravity. There is a limit to it from the standpoint of mass, where you're trying to build up speed and et cetera, your speed, your weight becomes infinite. You know, time becomes somewhat infinite, stuff like that. But gravity, so it's believed to be the workaround. Right, no, it's fascinating. I'm sorry.
Let's move on. We have more questions. Okay, keep it real. F, I never understood how you know that the, I never understood, you know, is the U.S. helped the Jews during the Holocaust, but have to financially support them. Shouldn't it be Germany's sole responsibility for Germany? I'm not for Israel. I'm not sure 100%. I mean, the U.S. didn't Germany do shit for Jews during the Holocaust, and that's like to its eternal shame. But
well, we turned them away, right?
Like, yeah, we sure fucking did. Like the St. Louis.
Yeah.
That ship of people who were like basically hopscotching from like Cuba all over the East Coast and kept being refused at port of entry. So yeah, no, and you know, FDR repeatedly refused to bomb the train lines to the camps and all that. Basically the thinking was, you know, well, we'll defeat Nazi Germany and then the Holocaust will end. But in the meantime, you know, people are dying. Shouldn't it be Germany's sole responsibility for Israel? I think so. You might throw in the you know, Poland and Ukrainians too, because they had quite a role there too.
Banderites. I mean, but let's keep in mind though, Israel is being, we don't care about Israel proper. What we care about is using them as a tool for U.S. military conflict in the Middle East, where we don't have to entirely get involved in. I mean, Pathway to Persia, the document in and of itself, used Israel to go after Iran and basically blame Israel for it, saying we don't really have anything to do with the fact that Israel is going after Tehran. I mean, obviously, it doesn't work that way in practice. But
here's a question I don't have a good answer to. Wednesday, thanks so much for the very generous donation, $10. Love your analysis. Off topic, what do you guys know about Eritrea and its dictator? I don't know, Dick. How about you?
Eritrea. My knowledge of Eritrea comes in the context of the war in Ethiopia, where Ethiopia was divided, where there was, oh God, so long I haven't done this. The TPLF tried to effectively take over the Ethiopian government. The TPLF had been in power for like 30 something years. Eritrea made peace with Abiy Abbas in Ethiopia, in which case they were working together to go after the TPLF. But I don't know specifically about Eritrea. I only know him in the context of working with the Ethiopian government to go after the TPLF in that war.
I will read up on that. Thanks for the donation, Phileas Fab. I've heard that instead of being anti-trans, Iran's homophobia manifests itself as demanding that homosexuals change their sex, and that some trans people here cite Iran as a pro-trans example. That's true, and it's strange, but true. The Iranians will say like, oh, well, Ted, if you say that you now want to, you're gay and you want to have sex with guys, actually you should become a girl, then you'll be straight and you'll be a trans woman and you'll be a straight trans woman. Some twisted logic.
That's intense. I get the logic, but Jesus, that's intense.
It's intense, yeah. No, it's true. FUCO, South Korea just ordained a robot as a Buddhist monk. Now with sex robots, we can bang a robot, then ask a robot to forgive our sins.
Sex robots are not a bad idea. Now, let me explain why I say that.
I'm all ears.
That sounds very, that sounds horrible, right? The problem is, look, there is a problem with incels. I think incels are a problem.
Yes.
And the situation where it's like, we hate women because women aren't interested in you. Okay, well, women may just not be interested in you for various reasons, right? Like, some people are clearly going to be oriented in a sense that they are not going to have the interest of women while simultaneously still have the sexual drives of everybody else. Now, right. You can say prostitution is fine. And maybe sex robots takes away from the prostitution. But obviously, those people they need attention in some way.
They have a problem. No, I mean, it's and therefore society has a problem. I agree with that.
Yeah. It has to be resolved. In some countries, they pay for prostitution. They will say, we're going to give old people prostitutes in order to help with their urges and everything else. Well, we don't do that here. And I think it would be a little bit weird if we tried to do that here. But a sex robot? Hey, never know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with that. Yeah. All right. Manchild, thanks for the $2. If Israel's economy is hitting $1 trillion, why do we still need to subsidize their defense industry? Is Bibi just a billionaire's kid who still wants his parents to pay for his car insurance? I mean, so this is something that we had on the rundown, so I'm glad that that Manchild brought it up. So Netanyahu was on 60 Minutes yesterday. He said that, among other things, he wants to Israel to wean itself off the $3.8 billion a year it gets as an allowance from the United States. That's not even counting all the supplemental military and economic assistance it receives for things like the genocide in Gaza and in Lebanon and so on. But that's just like the allowance it's been on since Camp David, right? My take on this, JT, is that basically Netanyahu is looking at the numbers. He sees that there's not going to be any money coming in from the U.S. within the next 10 years. So therefore, he's just being realistic and saying, like, yeah, we've got to fly free, little bird, because the no one likes us anymore. He blames social media. He said, oh, you can see that the rise of social media 20 years ago is when we started losing our narrative. I have a different take. My take on this is social media, for all of its faults, allows information to bypass traditional corporate gatekeepers. And so, we're seeing imagery of genocide that we never would have seen at all, if like we had to rely on CBS Evening News. And therefore, people are getting more unfiltered information, whatever the cause. I guess my question is, why the fuck have we been paying $3.8 billion a year for so many years, for decades? And I guess my question for you, Jamarl, is if Israel is completely like desuckled off the U.S. teat and is no longer gobbling up our tax money, will they be even freer to operate with a hand to do whatever the fuck they want? Will their influence in Washington wane? I mean, will they become more of a pariah state? Will they go more off the reservation? Or is the fact that they get money from us, does that restrain them or constrain them in any way?
I think, okay, you make a really good point, and I agree with your point. I think the money, from my point of view, that Israel is the United States dog in the region. They allow the U.S. influence in Middle Eastern affairs, and it breaks up this idea of united Arab panacea of sorts in that particular region. The money that we effectively give them is to assist them in doing just that, meaning our work in that region. But let's be honest, Israel also has its own mind, meaning there are things that Israel may want to accomplish that the United States, let's say they chafe at the yoke, or they chafe at the leash that the United States effectively has them on, quote unquote, has them on. And so if you think about it, yeah, if you were, see, this is problematic for Israel though, in one sense. Yeah, you may want to be off the yoke of the US, meaning you may want to be able to do what you want to do in the region to create this greater Israel in a way that other US presidents may have, let's say, not necessarily allowed. And it's clear that when the US asserts itself and say, stop, currently, with the political support, the support from the United Nations Security Council, or support like a veto in the United Nations, all of these things are beneficial to Israel. It goes beyond the money. If you think of the case that the United States was arguing, where it made the argument that Israel has the right to effectively commit a genocide, or if you think of U.S. policy, where the U.S. effectively lied under the Biden administration that Israel was starving people, which should have affected the way the United States engaged them, the U.S. just lied about it. So it goes beyond just the money. And it goes into this kind of political protection that Israel gets. Now, the catch becomes, I get that they may want to be, let's say, removed from this much U.S. influence. But I think they need to kind of reconcile the world that they would exist in without U.S. support, even beyond the money. Mm-hmm. It's not just the money, right? Like, meaning if you get a U.N. Security Council resolution going against Israel where military influence is applied to the state of 8 million people, well, what does that look like? Even if you don't get the money, even if you have a military, that is problematic for you moving forward in the world without the U.S. backing you and without the U.S. support. So, yeah, I agree with you that they may chafe at that leash. They may not like that leash. They maybe want to be off that leash. I agree with you that they're looking at the U.S., let's say, the sentiment of the American public shift heavily in a direction against them.
And permanently.
Yeah, but they need to reconcile what that world looks like without the U.S. support, regardless of what Netanyahu wants in the context of this greater Israel.
Yeah.
That's my
point. No, I think that's right. Let's talk about this report from Euromed Human Rights Monitor. And basically, yes, it's confirming and documenting something that those of us who follow this this story have known for a while, that basically Israel employs systematic sexual violence in its jails and prisons against both men and women. Yes. One of the most, Nicholas Kristof sort of details in today's New York Times some of the lowlights of this report. And to my mind, one of the worst ones is a victim of being sodomized by IDF troops in an Israeli facility. At one point, you know, they're just, you know, putting things up his rear end. And at one point, they all like kick off and he smells cigarette smoke. He realized, oh, it's time for their cigarette break. It's so methodical that they like stop the torture. Like, oh, dudes, it's, you know, it's like, it's our government mandate break. You know, like, we're not going to torture on the clock here, off the clock. It's that systemic, right? It's just sort of like time to make the donuts. Like, it's not like bored soldiers at Abu Ghraib who have, you know, are poorly trained and don't know what the fuck they're doing and end up in a Stanford prison experiment kind of, you know, mentality. This is about people who, it's just like, this is policy and this is what we do. This is, we, you know, time to make the donuts.
Yeah. And every accusation is an admission. Like, God, man, I nearly got fired for this. Like this story is mind blowing to me. So when the New York Times was reporting, basically the New York Times came out with a story effectively saying, we can't find the rapes, talking about what they called Hamas raping all of these women associated in the October 7th raid. And my thing was like, okay, but where are they? If indeed you're claiming this, because they were claiming that they were cutting the heads off of babies, mm-hmm, that all of these women were
babies in the microwave.
Yeah, all of this stuff. And my thing was like, okay, but where are the rapes? New York Times comes out with a story saying we can't find all of this, quote, systemic rapes that Israel is claiming happened to Hamas. And, you know, it got to the point where when I ran the story, I was threatened with being fired. Basically saying, you know, I don't care if New York Times says it, that effectively everybody else is claiming it's true, so we pretend that it's true. And now you have finally the reality coming out of, no. The systemic rapes are taking place in the Israeli prisons against Palestinian men and women. And again, I point to the case where they raped that guy on camera. As you point out, where the guy was bleeding internally and nearly died from his wounds. And the majority of Israeli society, when asked on the news, said that should be fair game. And they raided the prison to free the soldiers that committed the rapes. Like, it's not just a jail issue. It's a societal issue. Mm. And that stuff needs to be reconciled. I'm glad the New York Times finally observed reality, something that everybody knew was taking place and that nobody would ultimately talk about. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. And it's a societal issue. It's not just an Israeli IDF issue. It's a societal issue where it's accepted by the society.
You know, Josh Gotthammer would say, well, we're picking on the Israelis because rape happens in other countries. But when rape happens in other countries, they're not doing it with your tax dollars.
Right.
I mean, right. The rapists are not paid by the U.S. government.
And then that's systemic. Like, it's not like, I mean, I think your example is great. It's like, hey, we're raping this guy. We're calling trauma to this guy's intestines where he's bleeding to death, but it's a cigarette break, so we got to head out, and we'll be back in 30 minutes.
Yeah, don't go away. Be right back.
Yeah, we'll be back. Just later, we'll be back. Yeah. I mean, that's outrageous. Like, it's one, look, man, I accept bad apples. This is not a bad apple. This is policy. There's a difference.
Yeah. One more last question about this topic. I want to talk about Laredo. So Annie Anna, Satan Yahoo wants to remove U.S. influence, but how do we remove Israel's influence from the U.S.? Well, it's like saying, how do you get money out of politics, right? I mean, Israel will have influence in the United States as long as it has an effective lobbying campaign, as long as it has a significant minority of Americans who support it and care about it and think it's a priority. And when that stops to be the case, then it won't have that support. I mean, I think the idea that, I mean, Netanyahu is not a dumb guy, and he can see within 10 years, Israel's not going to be able to count on U.S. funding anymore. So in a way, I'm like, right there is like your prediction. Just, you know, it's kind of like, it's like in the Addams Family movie, where one of the characters says, like, why is everyone dressed in black? Is there going to be, did someone die? And the little girl goes, wait. It's just wait 10 years, you know? It'll solve itself. Laredo, six migrants, obviously migrants, were found dead in a cargo train boxcar. Laredo is right on the border. It's a huge trading hub. 62% of Texas's land port trade goes through Laredo. A little mysterious is what happened to them. You know, you would expect that they baked to death in the boxcar, but it hasn't been that hot. It's been in the 80s and low 90s at most in Texas. I mean, obviously, we're being asked to speculate here, but what do you think may have happened? I mean, they just started investigating. And I guess the question is, you know, these kind of things happen from time to time. There was the semi-truck a few years back full of, of migrants who were sneaking in, and something went wrong and a lot of them died in there. I mean, thoughts?
Even if it's 80 degrees, if it's enclosed.
Yeah, it's getting much hotter.
Yeah, it's like dogs being in the car at 80 degrees. They're going to die in that car. And people may also. I don't know if they were trapped in it at that point. I mean, I think this does say something about our immigration system and people willing to take risks to get here. Coyotes, that's the other thing, right? Where people who effectively make money from putting people in these circumstances to try to get them into the United States undercover. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's sad. I mean, like, it's... We have a screwed up immigration system in general. It's sad. I don't know another word except, but I don't want anybody losing their life trying to have a better life.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I guess one would hope that, maybe it's possible for, I think this was Union Pacific Railroad. Maybe there's ways to sort of be more proactive in terms of searching the trains to make sure this sort of thing isn't happening for the train company's own good. We're going to have a Q&A show, 12 noon Eastern time. So guys, if you have questions for Robbie, myself, JT, any or all of us, you have comments, anything you want to say, this is a free fire zone, unless something major breaks between now and 12 noon in 2 hours from now. It'll be basically anything you guys want to talk about. So do tune in here at 12 noon, and we will enjoy that, and we'll enjoy seeing you. Thanks for your support. I'm going to see if I can hit this button over here while you – I'm going to put Robbie in here and just see if you guys – in case I go away, you guys close out the show. I'm still trying to figure out this transition here, so here we go.
No worries.
Go ahead.
Look, you guys are listening to Deprogram, Ted Rall, Jamal Thomas, Robbie. I need to get your last name, Robbie, because for some reason I feel weird talking to Robbie West.
West, like the direction. W-E-S-T.
Oh, West. Robbie West. Okay. Ted Rall, Jamal Thomas, Robbie West.
Now, I do need to update. I do need to work on my dress code. because
you're fine.
I look like a cheap pimp from Little Rock, and you're over here you're looking like a established businessman from New Orleans, and it's just I gotta step up my game, New Orleans.
I appreciate that. Somebody say he looks like he plays jazz or something like that.
I mean, it's like, look, at least go upgrade to the darker t-shirt.
A darker, I know, right? It's like classy yourself up a little bit.
Yeah. The white t-shirt is definitely like an undershirt. The colored shirt is like, oh, you can just wear that, you know.
Robbie, I appreciate you.
Ted, why are you so racist against white t-shirts?
Well, you should commit fully to the look, Robbie. Just get like a wife beater.
I've thought about it, but my wife, she actually banned those. She's like, you're already redneck enough.
She did?
100%. She's like, Robbie, look, listen, I will eat squirrels. I will eat whatever it is you bring home from the woods. But the wife beater, that serves a bridge too far.
Wait, fed your wife squirrels?
Oh, God, yes.
You know what's funny? There's a show on, what is it called? Bootleggers. I think it's Bootleggers or something like that, that comes on Discovery. And the guy is always without a shirt on, is always wearing a wife beater. My mom one day was like, why is that guy always in a wife beater? It could be like 20 degrees outside. He's wearing a wife beater. It is hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
I mean, let me tell you all crazy this. No, we are, but and then we'll go
away. Yeah, very quickly, and then I'm hitting the button. Yeah.
So here, Ted, you've been here to our house. Uh-huh. For those of you who do not know, my wife has a Black Lives Matter flag, and I got a Confederate battle flag right there next to each other, right there on the wall. I mean, if you want to know the poster child of what a interracial family looks like, which race is the biggest joke in the world, come to my house. I'll feed you possum, and we'll just have a good time.
Okay.
I'll eat that possum.
That is some strange American shit. Okay. Bye, everyone.
Fried, grilled, it don't matter.
Stay tuned to TMI Show with me and Manila Chan, except it'll be Robbie Westphal again for Manila Chan. That's coming up right now. Thanks, JT. See you at 12 noon Eastern time for the Q&A. Bye.
Have a good one, guys. Be safe.